From WXXI News, this is Innovation Friday on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, welcome to Innovation Friday. Just 1 hour today. And if you've ever listened to Innovation Friday on this program, you know that our editor of the Innovation Trail, Matthew Leonard, always packs a lot into 2 hours. So we've got a lot to cover in just 1 hour. Looking down the rundown, we're going to talk about 25 years after the Americans with Disabilities Act laid out federal guidelines for accessible housing. New reports from upstate suggest that much of that housing is expensive and segregated, maybe not what the original intention was a quarter century ago. Coming up also, we're gonna hear Matthew's going to, in many ways, help us pay tribute to Roland Clement, who died this week at the age of 102, Matthew, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And when I met him a couple of years ago, he was 100. And I had a long conversation with him over a couple of lunchtimes, actually. And I just wanted to,
we're going to get to that.
You'll hear to that.
We're going to hear you chatting with the 100-year-old Roland Clement, which is just going to be fabulous. But before we get there, let's start with that two-day healthcare innovation challenge, because it's one thing for design students to work sort of abstractly, but they're trying to come up with, at RIT, solutions for real-world medical dilemmas.
Right, and this is interesting. So we've got two reports done by WXXI reporters, really on how new technology to benefit people comes about. How is it developed? What are the ideas? And so we've got two stories. The first one lets us eavesdrop on the development of a new device to help people who are recovering from stroke. The RIT's Simone Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship has this semi-annual thing called an Idea Lab. There was one 2 weeks ago, and it's a workshop over a weekend. It pairs students with teams from Rochester Regional Health System who bring real-world healthcare problems to design teams, and they have to solve them, basically, in the course of the 2 days. So it's a really intense sort of process. So our reporter, the WXXI's Daniel Price, followed a project developing some wearable technology to help stroke patients maintain good posture. Here it comes.
We are Team Spineline. We kind of have this cheeky product name,
The engineering and design students on stage presenting their concept have been working on this prototype for a grand total of 2 days. For their faculty coach, Amos Scully, the quick turnaround is both a challenge and part of the fun.
This is a deep dive. Like, you just like dive yourself into a project, and in 24 hours, you're supposed to understand it, come up with ideas, propose a solution.
Physical therapist Kelly Schauf has come to the Idea Lab after noticing many of her stroke patients needed help regaining their normal posture during their recovery.
I've more so been thinking it as a patient problem that we were frequently seeing in the clinic. Having a device that could do that for these people would be amazing to help them recover faster.
She hopes students can create a wearable device that would alert patients when they're leaning too far to one side or the other.
He is walking with a straight cane.
To help students imagine a real patient, Shelf creates a character recovering from a stroke.
He has adopted some poor movement patterns, so he's relying on the cane for support.
She calls him Dave.
Favoring his left leg, so the cane's on his right side.
One of the students quickly makes a House of Cards reference. Dave sounds a lot like the character Doug Stamper on the popular Netflix series. As the brainstorming continues, Dave morphs into Doug.
There are some patients like Doug that, you know, they're using this cane and they're here, they're hiking their hip to get their leg through, they're shortening their spine.
After the crash course in body mechanics, the students take the afternoon to try out different concepts. They suggest everything from a simple app for an iPhone worn around the neck to something that would directly change the impulses within the brain. Schauf quickly dismisses that idea. Neurosurgery is definitely off the table.
Okay, so prioritize your user needs, prioritize your problems.
By 1 o'clock the next afternoon, the students are presenting their physical prototype, a vest with sensors and a vibrating alert that pulses more intensely the further the patient leans. If there's real danger of a fall, the device starts to make noise. The vest also logs data to help patients understand their posture habits. Amos Scully thinks teaming up with healthcare workers helps students see the real-life benefits of their ideas.
And I think there's something compelling about, like, you know, students not making a project for some kind of, you know, company, that they're actually doing it for the healthcare system. I think that's a really good precedent of, like, where your energies could go to benefit people as opposed to financial profit for someplace, yeah.
Past Idea Lab projects have become reality, like a mobile centrifuge unit for blood samples now in use by Rochester Regional Health System. The student-designed product dropped the rate of bad samples from 5% to 0%, saving the system nearly $100,000 a year. Team Spinaline, our posture vest inventors, haven't quite made a business plan yet, but someone suggests their prototype might work for golfers too. Expanding the potential market could also bring the price point down. For first-year industrial design student Jeremiah Eister, the weekend workshop feels like it could be a launching pad to a real business.
I think we can all see a lot of potential in it, and so it wouldn't be smart to back out at this point when it seems so like it's something that is in reach.
For WXXI News, I'm Danielle Price.
All right, so as Matthew, you've been saying, that's kind of a quick turnaround project, at least in terms of the concept there.
Right, so there's a lot of pressure. There's a real time crunch on. You know, it's basically like a hackathon kind of model where, you know, it's kind of lots of pizza and that kind of intense model. But
yes.
But they're constantly getting feedback from health professionals who come with a very, very specific issue. In that one, you get this sense of trying to balance between, you know, provide a mechanism for people to be more independent. And it's coming out of the clinical environment where a practitioner just can see there's an issue and there's a piece of technology that they think can sort of support that. In this next story from our colleague Michelle Faust, who does the lion's share of our health reporting,
mm-hmm.
This is a completely different sort of timeline. This is a project that's kind of going to take probably another decade to really come to fruition. It's very ambitious, but it's got some real implications for, you know, for how our health is monitored. So, you know, the analogy that you hear in this story is, you know, when the check engine light on your car comes on, that usually means something bad has already happened, right? In the car, like there's already an issue that you have to address.
Yep.
So this is kind of, doctors are saying that they're, you know, by the time the symptoms have appeared in your body, then that the problem is already present. So what Michelle Faust reports on in this little story is the progress of research into a customizable, embeddable sensor that could give indications of disease before the symptoms appear. Let's hear it.
At 59 years old, Michael Froome just got a new heart. His problem goes back 20 years after a chest pain led his doctors to order a cardiac stress test.
When they put on the last electrode so that the monitor comes live with your data, someone in the room goes, oh, that's not good.
Spencer Rosero, a cardiologist at the University of Rochester Medical Center, is one of Froome's doctors. He has an idea that could cut the number of hospital visits patients like Froome have to make.
When that oil light goes on, things are pretty bad in your car, right? So, but you don't know it until it goes off. So when patients develop symptoms, you've already failed all your feedback, all the feedback mechanisms that provide the balance have already failed. Now you feel sick. If we can catch it earlier, better quality of life, less time in the hospital, less office visits.
Basically, Rosero wants to hack the body to see what's going wrong at the earliest signs. To catch things as they happen in your engine, you need a camera watching things move around in real time. How would you do this in the body?
And the only way to do that would be to use live cells that are have their own features and their own ability to measure what's going on around them, filter out the noise, and then respond.
Rosero's answer, a tiny living chip implanted in the body that's also bioengineered to talk to cells and report back to doctors in real time. It could be customized to both the individual patient and the part of the body where it's being used.
So the cells are the upfront, they're sentries. They're really the upfront line, and they interact with the environment. They don't know they're part of a sensor network. They just do what they're supposed to do. And then we just monitor their response.
The prototype biosensor is about the size of a watch battery. Dr. Rosero expects future versions to be smaller still. It uses internal electronics, a cell membrane, and photo-optics to watch what's happening inside of the body.
This is the side that gives us the window of opportunity to look and peek what the cells are doing. The other side lets the cells communicate with the rest of the body.
Commercial application of Rosero's biosensor is still 10 or 15 years away, but it could have a wide variety of applications. The technology could catch heart failure before it happens. Oncologists could lower a dosage of chemotherapy well before a cancer patient develops a toxic reaction. The sensor could even be adjusted to directly target medications to individual body parts. For Michael Froome, a chance to use the biosensor would have been a happier option. As it is, doctors have had to keep him wired to devices that he's carried around in a backpack.
You don't want to just prevent sickness. You want to live. And it's been very difficult to live. I mean, I've survived just fine. You would have people dancing in the street if the only thing that Dr. Rosero's sensor did was stop them from having weekly blood draws.
In an era of digital wristbands that monitor everything from your activity to your heart rate, Rosero imagines a future when his device could read out information on your smartphone, improving diagnostic effort for doctors and consumer desires to know more about their own health. Michelle Faust, WXXI News.
All right, so we've got a lot to come here still in this hour, Matthew. And
sure, absolutely. And a little snippet of looking ahead. We're going to talk with our colleague Kara Miller from Innovation Hub in Boston about an interesting idea, what the cultural tensions between East and West can actually do for innovation as a kind of dynamic for innovation. But in that story from Michelle also, we heard that 10 to 15-year timeline for commercialization. With the first story we heard that Danielle reported on, you had a piece of technology that is going, you know, out of this design lab basically to the engineering department and could be kind of realized much more quickly. But as we also heard, you know, if you can get another market engaged, like the golfing market, to bring down that price point, it makes that technology that much more accessible. So it's kind of an interesting, for me, an interesting kind of insight into how technology and healthcare kind of merge.
It is Innovation Friday, just the first hour. Next hour is a special edition of Second Opinion Live. But this hour, Innovation Friday, with my colleague Matthew Leonard, who is the editor of the Innovation Trail. And our next story takes us to, for me, takes me back to my childhood. I knew the name Rachel Carson and the book Silent Spring. I was saying to Matthew during the break, I must have read it in grade school. That makes sense?
Right, sure. So published in 62 and an absolutely pivotal book in many, many ways. A real classic, you know, in its own right in terms of prose. But the book changed the debate in the US about the widespread use of pesticides and particularly DDT. But less well known is a man who also has a part in this story. His name is Roland Clement, and he passed away just this March 21st at the age of 102. I actually got an email from his daughter advising people that he'd passed on. Now, Roland was an environmental innovator in his own right, and he had a really interesting connection to the whole story of Silent Spring. He was also a Cornell graduate, so he's got a big, strong upstate connection. He was also the vice president and an ecologist at the National Audubon Society for nearly 20 years. He was later a fellow at Yale, and he also played a really pivotal role in the foundation of what we now call the Environmental Defense Fund. So just before his 100th birthday, I had the chance to spend time with Roland in his home in New Haven, Connecticut. I was talking to him as part of a range of interviews I was doing to mark the 50th anniversary of the release of Silent Spring in 1962. By then, he was living in a high-rise aged care facility, and from his window, we were able to sit and watch the flight of a colony of peregrine falcons that were using the roof of a neighbouring apartment building in downtown New Haven as their eyrie. Now, peregrine falcons, as Roland, a lifelong birdman, quickly reminded me, are the fastest creature in American skies. At the time that Silent Spring was released, their numbers, along with other raptors like eagles, were in sharp decline, and that was largely because of the widespread dispersal of chemicals like DDT in post-war America. The revival of raptor populations is now directly attributed to the use reduction and ultimate banning of DDT in 1972, a process that both Rachel Carson and others like Roland Clement played a major role in. In fact, with Rachel Carson's health declining rapidly during the writing and release of Silent Spring in the early 60s, Roland Clement often stepped in as a proxy in the wake of the withering personal attacks made against Rachel Carson by the powerful US chemical industry, which was overwhelmingly male, by the way. But Clement wasn't totally misty-eyed about Carson, as you'll hear in this interview I did with him. Others had also been working hard on the DDT and pesticide issue, as Carson herself acknowledged. Indeed, Carson and Clement both gave evidence to President Kennedy's Presidential Commission on Pesticides in 1963 on different days before they actually ever met in person. So this is part of a much longer conversation I had with Roland. He's just shy of 100 years old in this recording, but you'll hear him incredibly lucid. He was grumbling about the lack of excitement in the age facility he was living in, and he cursed his double chin. He said he hated it. He thought it made him look terrible. He was a pretty handsome guy in the day. He was also still painting watercolours, and he found radio and TV frustrating because his hearing had diminished. But in this segment, he talks about his own background, his passion for birds, and then he moves on to reflect on Silent Spring and this pivotal moment in America's environmental movement.
Well, my father was a Belgian who came to French Canada to conduct music at a small college. He married there, and they moved to Massachusetts, where I was born, in 1912. And I was a boy bird watcher, you might say. I became fascinated with birds at the age of 8 because I saw a bird close to and I was so amazed that I wanted to learn more about them. So I became a naturalist, although I've been called a biologist, staff scientist, staff ecologist, whatever. I'm really a naturalist interested in the whole outdoors and in the human condition and trying to adapt to the use of the planet. We've made a rather poor job of that. So my education was delayed. I went into business for a while. I was a bookkeeper and a private secretary for 10 years. So eventually I left that, thanks to the Great Depression, can reorganize. And so I went back to school. I did 2 years of wildlife management and forestry conservation at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. I became editor of the New England Bulletin of Bird Life at the Boston Museum of Natural History. And then the war caught up with me, and I was an Air Force weatherman for 3.5 years, mostly in subarctic Canadian Labrador. And there, in addition to my duties as a weatherman, all my spare time was spent studying the birds, the mammals, everything in that country. And so that rounded me out quite a bit. And so when I came back after the war, fortunately, Uncle Sam had said that anybody who wants to go to college may do so. And so this was my last opportunity. I went to Brown University in Rhode Island and got my bachelor's degree and then did an extra year of work at Cornell and got a master's degree in order to go into bird conservation work with the Audubon Societies. I spent 8 years doing that, a sort of one-man jack-of-all-trades, in Rhode Island, and then was invited to become headquarters biologist for the National Audubon Society in New York City. Now, at that time, we were using a lot of DDT, which was a post-World War II product, by the way, using it against Dutch elm disease in the Northeast, and it was devastating local bird populations. So I was being asked about this, and of course there was very little background information, and the only groups who were curious were the garden clubs. You see, before Rachel Carson, the public had no concept of what was happening to the environment. And so I sort of wet my feet a little bit, thinking and wondering about the implications of the use of these new chemicals post-World War II. So when I came to National Audubon in 1958, working in New York City, the society had just employed a biologist to dog watch a fire ant control program in the southeastern U.S. that the U.S. Department of Agriculture was conducting. And so he and I put our heads together and decided that the oncoming problems being created by the decision to try to eradicate insect pests like the gypsy moth and Dutch elm disease and the fire ant and several others were going to be a major problem. So I undertook to acquaint myself with the biology involved. I had the background. I knew the wildlife community and the university community, although I didn't have a PhD in this field, for example. But I could talk to the experts. And that way, I became an expert because I knew 10 people to telephone and say, hey, what's going on, you see? And so that is the background. And this is why I was active in the field before Rachel Carson. And so when she came along, she was a colleague. She had the tremendous advantage of being already a well-established writer, so people would pay attention to her, you see. So I didn't meet Rachel Carson until the Audubon Society gave her an Audubon Medal in 1963, the year after the publication of the book Silent Spring. However, I knew several of Rachel Carson's friends, and one of them, especially one of her best friends, Shirley Briggs, for example, was a close Audubon contact of mine. I would see Shirley every month or two, either in Washington or in New York. And so I knew about Rachel through Shirley Briggs, you see. But in 60 about, the president of the Audubon Society, John Baker, put a set of galleys on my desk. He said, Houghton Mifflin has asked us to endorse this book they're about to publish by Rachel Carson. He said, tell me what you think of it. Should we get involved in it? So I read the galleys, and I urged Mr. Baker to get behind this effort because it was in the right ballpark, you might say, even though the details had not yet been worked out. And so, unfortunately, for reasons of his own, probably being concerned about the conflict it might create if we took a stand on this, Baker never gave the book Audubon's endorsement. Neither did his successor, a man named Buckheister. They kept out of the fray, but they gave me the freedom to go out and speak. In other words, it was my neck, all my responsibility, with no official endorsement for several years until a third president came along and decided that the public demanded our participation. So he put Audubon on record as endorsing limitations on the use of DDT. And then I get involved with a new group of scientists and lawyers on Long Island, which became the Environmental Defense Fund. And they challenged the use of DDT in mosquito control on the Long Island, New York State salt marshes. So this put me in the thick of things, and I grew with the movement, and although I was not officially a member because of my exposure as Audubon's spokesperson, you see. But I consider myself midwife to the EDF. I made it possible for them to do things that they could not have done alone. And Charlie Worcester, who's one of the founders and has remained a good friend all these years, considers me one of the early founding members of EDF. So it was a fun group to work with.
Roland Clement, talking to our Matthew Leonard at the age, he was about 100 at the time, just yep. passed away at the age of 102. And Matthew, just real briefly, yep. for more context here, he was an environmental innovator who had a very important role to play when Rachel Carson herself, people might not have realized, was sick herself and during some very critical times there.
Right, and he was pulled into this series of public debates that were held between the American Chemical Society and the chemical industry, basically the peak body, and you know, Carson was kind of very roundly attacked. The book came out in September. She didn't go on television for about. She did a very kind of considered response to the whole attack against the book. About 6 months later on television, a very famous TV appearance, but then her health was kind of dwindling as she was living with cancer, and Roland Clement and others, but Roland particularly, did a whole series of public appearances where he was basically defending the science of the book as well.
Where can we hear more of that?
So we're going to post edit the quite a long set of interviews I did with him down. He's a great storyteller, as you can hear,
absolutely.
And he was really in charge of his faculties at the time, and I'll put some more context up. Also, if you go to the National Audubon Society's website, there's a really beautiful obituary for him and a photograph of him back in the day in the 40s standing on top of a mountain with some binoculars on. It's a great photo, so check it out.
Great work there. All right, let's shift gears once again. Our colleague Veronica Volk's in studio. What's going on, Matthew?
So Veronica's here. Hey, Veronica, good to have you with us on Innovation.
Always nice to see you, Veronica.
Thank you. Great to be here, guys.
And folks who may have caught Need to Know, WXXI's Need to Know program, or or go to wxxinews.org right now and you can watch the program. This week's edition, our colleague Helene Biondutti-Hofer spoke with Centre for Disability Rights activists Stephanie Woodward and Justin Young, and they were talking about an initiative to get more people with disabilities into the voting booth. There's a really disproportionate underrepresentation of people with disabilities amongst the voters, the voter cohort in New York State. And that includes doing work with the state's Electoral Commission on things like the lack of accessible technology. So voting booths actually have technology in them that's not accessible for people with disability. And this kind of links to some work that you've been doing, Veronica, on the issue of accessibility, particularly around housing, for a series of programs we're going to be running next week. So just tell us a little bit about what you were kind of touching on in the programs you've been doing.
Yeah, sure. Well, we've been talking about accessibility in a couple of different ways. You spoke about housing. We're going to hear from somebody who's a mother, and she was looking to move into a house where she and her daughter could both live and have enough room to move around. And she found a lot of trouble with the lack of housing stock that had a couple basic accessibility features. And she was actually forced to move into an apartment instead, even though she'd rather be in a house.
It's just a lot harder to find accessible housing here. I mean, unless you're going into an apartment. And there's a lot of homeowners out there that, they look to rent their house out, but they don't necessarily plan on doing it to the chick in the chair that might mark up your walls quite a bit, bump into things, which I tend to do. But so it took a while to find housing, and then, really to have to settle into a place where I really just felt very confined. So it's frustrating. It's very frustrating.
So there's, and the hook, I guess, was we were looking at, 25 years after the American with Disabilities Act, that putting these federal mandates for any federally supported housing facility to have 5% of the housing designated as accessible, we're sort of looking at the gaps between the legislation and the reality, right?
In terms Absolutely. Of you have the laws that pertain to apartments and public housing, and then you have the Fair Housing Act, which is multiple family units, but there's sort of no law that governs single family privately funded housing.
Right. And as part of the reporting, in addition to the reporting that you're doing, we're also going to run some reporting that our Innovation Trail reporter Ryan Delaney did in Syracuse, looking at some of those issues, particularly in the private rental market and some of the challenges for people there. But one of the other voices you got in the series that we'll hear next week is a voice talking about a concept called visitability and how that might change our notions of accessibility and sort of help alleviate the issue. Do you want to just sort of set up this tape for us?
Right,
now?
Sure. This is Jonathan White. He's the Architectural Research and Design Associate at the Center for Inclusive Design and Environmental Access at the University of Buffalo. It's quite a title. And he's talking about universal design, this concept of making the environment easier to navigate for everybody, not just people with disabilities, but everybody across the board.
So there's a gap in the accessibility laws that don't really apply to privately funded single family housing. And so when most people build a house for their family, if they don't have a disability, they don't include features for people with disabilities. And so when a person with a disability needs a house, they can't find one on the market. It's tough enough to find a house that you like, that's in a good neighborhood and everything else. And now try to find one that's accessible, it's nearly impossible. So the idea of visitability was to try to fill this gap and to provide just a basic level of access. We're not talking full accessibility and grab bars and everything like that, but maybe just putting blocking in the walls for future installation of grab bars, and at least having one entrance that's zero step or could be easily made zero step. Having at least a half bath on the ground floor, basically making it so the house could be visited by someone with a disability or live there short term, or make the house easily fixed later. So they can get in the house, look at the house, and then buy it, and then make the changes they need without a lot of expense.
So we're talking about a couple different things here. We're talking about building new houses and increasing the housing stock, and we're also talking about making neighborhoods more diverse. When you add more visitable housing, you're not just changing the options for people with disabilities or anyone with a mobility challenge, which includes people as they age, of course.
Right.
But you're also making neighborhoods more diverse, and you're allowing for more healthy community.
A more integrated community, yeah, absolutely. Right. And that's definitely a point that comes through in the tape that you got from Jensen, one of the people that you speak to in your reports next week. Veronica Volks, a reporter here at WXXI News. Thanks so much, Veronica. We're looking forward to hearing the reports on Morning Edition starting Monday.
Does she actually use tape still? That's such a lovely term, isn't it?
It's one of those kind of professional things.
Film,
where you
tape.
Just say,
yeah, of course. Tune in Morning Edition.
Yeah, right,
exactly.
Thank you, Veronica.
Thank you, guys.
We have to take a very short break, and we're coming back with one of our favorite recurring guests here. Kara Miller joins us. A lot to talk about on Innovation Friday. I'm Evan Dawson. Matthew Leonard, the editor of the Innovation Trail, is here, and we continue the conversation next on Connections. Welcome back to Connections Innovation Friday. Matthew Leonard, this next segment was written by a robot.
Right. Well, not quite. As usual, you know, semi-regularly we get to talk to our colleagues at the Innovation Hub Project, innovationhub.org in Boston, and Kara Miller is with us on the line. Hi, Kara. It's been a couple of months, so we think we had the holidays.
I know. It's been a while. Well, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, anytime. We're always glad to you guys are always digging into interesting and exciting stuff, and we're just kind of a bit terrified by this first story, I think, probably, as people who, you know, probably pride themselves on being able to write professionally from time to time. So tell us some of the things you've been talking about. This first one, you've been looking into the role that robots might be playing in writing and even journalism. I think one of the things you wrote in your blog was something that the Associated Press is going to get robots,
right,
going to be reporting on sporting.
Are reporting. And it's this fascinating thing where very often, you know, when we talk about innovation, we, you know, talk about like, oh, what's going to happen in the future? And people think, oh, that's 10 years or 20 years down the line, that's never going to happen. This is already happening. So Forbes has computers writing up the earnings reports. Yahoo has them writing up their fantasy football descriptions. Edmunds has them writing up car descriptions. And the AP has them writing up a bunch of stuff, including college sports. And, you know, so basically what I'm saying is if you've read a newspaper at any point in the last, like, 2 years, you have been reading articles that you thought were written by people, but in fact were written by computers.
Okay.
Which is kind of a striking thing, right?
Well, sometimes, yeah. And even ones that were written by humans feel like they're written by computers. But sometimes.
Well, that's how they nicely blend together.
Right. Can you give us a sense of what that process looks like in reality in terms of...
Yeah, so what we've seen really is that there's been this tremendous maturity in what's called artificial intelligence, AI, in the last few years. And AI's been around for a long time. People talked about it for a long time. In fact, during the 90s, the government got so discouraged that they basically said, we really don't want to fund any more AI. This isn't going to go anywhere. Just forget about it. And it just sort of sat there dormant. And one of the people I talked to about this said, you know, the AI was sitting there waiting, and what it needed was data. And what we have now is a world of data, right? People have Fitbits on, and that's just a stream of data. And people are, we have numbers about how many people go online. We have numbers about all sorts of things. In fact, California uses computers to monitor all the time, in a way a human couldn't possibly do, earthquake reports. So that if that computer sees something happen that's abnormal, like they're looking at streams of data all the time, right? They see something happen that's abnormal, they immediately send something over the wire saying there was clearly a quake here and the epicenter was here and the level was this amount. Actually, I think we've got a little clip from Chris Hammond. I think we call this Hammond 4, if you have that. And he's just talking about sort of where this is going in terms of articles being written by computers.
In much the same way that a sports writer can teach another writer how to become a sports writer, or a financial writer can teach another writer to be a financial writer, we can teach the machine to look for the kinds of patterns that are important, figure out what the audience needs to hear, not just wants to hear, but needs to hear, and then turn that into impactful language.
Another nail in the coffin.
I was going to say, why do we need humans to do jobs anymore?
But that was
such a burden.
But it's interesting because artificial intelligence, I mean, it's one of those things, I mean, it's come up in the wake of this terrible airline tragedy as well, that artificial intelligence might have played a role in that. But the matching the data and the artificial intelligence is really key. So I get a sense from that clip as well that there's this the computers are learning these algorithms about effective language and ways to kind of reach audiences. And are they also connecting up with things like social media data? Is that another
Of way that's... Oh, no question about it. So One thing is he has sports writers teach the computer how to write sports. So I have to, so they teach them that, like, if the game score at the end is 50 to 10, that's a rout. But if it's 50 to 48, that's a squeaker. If one team is behind the whole time and then turns around at the end, like, that's a come from behind victory. So they understand, like, they understand the formula. In some ways, I think we have to teach ourselves what our own formulas are, that we all have formulas for the way we speak. And then those things get taught to computers. I think, you know, going from here, I think there's a real question about how good artificial intelligence can get. And my sense is, from everybody I talk to, even though I thought that's, you know, this is impossible, my sense is it can get very good. I mean, I said, are we gonna be at a point where we go home and sit on the couch and turn on a TV program and, like, the screenplay was written by a computer? And one of the people I talked to, the head of narrative science, which does the write-ups for the Big Ten Football League, he was like, yeah, basically, I think we're going there.
But isn't there – well, there's a couple of things. First of all, I'm with Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking in thinking that our future overlords are going to do bad things to us. But anyway, there's also a subjective component, isn't there, to – I guess what you're saying, Carr, is you build in and you sort of – program artificial intelligence to understand how to look for what is valuable, et cetera. But there's still always something subjective about how do you lead a story, who do you talk to, whose sound bites or quotes or references matter most. I mean, that just seems to be very complex. And perhaps my little brain is not wrapping around it well enough.
No, I think you're very right. And I think, you know, the sort of story-intensive journalism, it's not about to get eclipsed by computers. Yep. Right now, they're really good at data-driven things. You notice everything I've talked about is full of numbers. Sports is full of numbers.
Yep.
Financial reports are full of numbers. Real estate reports are full of numbers. And they're fantastic at those things. But they're getting better at other things. So you asked about social media before. There's actually a program that comes from there's a couple of big companies that write these financial reports and stuff and that churn these out. And one of them has a program called Snark. And it is actually taught the computer how to, like, be ironic and say snarky things, because they know that when people read certain write-ups, they expect them to be kind of personality driven.
Right. The skewed thing. On the screenplay thing, I mean, I think there's long been the criticism of, I can definitely see it's not a big jump to go from, kind of what, you know, can be called cookie cutter or sort of template screenplays, you know, that are sort of taught in screenwriting workshops, you know, over a weekend sort of putting that algorithm into, you know, and they just sort of fill in the blanks with, you know, generic characters and that kind of stuff. But at some point there's still the need for this kind of more profound emotional connection that I think, you know, still remains with us, you know, into human experience, and also those quirky from the side pieces that it'll probably take computers a bit longer to learn about.
I'm hoping so. I mean, for the sake of all of our jobs, I'm really hoping we're not going towards, you know, radio hosts who are computers.
Well, my,
you know,
my
then
goodness.
We're going to all have to find a new line of work.
Well, to Matthew's point, if our screenwriting and if that is so formulaic that it can be taught to computers, then I think we just need to get more creative. So anyway,
yes.
Matthew, there's plenty more on the agenda here. What else is on your list, Mr. Leonard?
So Kara's wanted to get you to talk about this. I was interested in this because we're looking at so much tension, I guess, ideologically between, you know, concepts of East and Western hemispheres. And you've taken an approach to sort of the voice that you're sort of going to present to us now is someone who's sort of looking at what that kind of polarity can mean in terms of creativity
right.
and motivation.
Right.
Walk us into that.
Right, and this is a big issue in terms of, as you say, creativity, innovation, because, you know, I talk to people all the time about these issues of innovation, and you will have people saying, you know, leaders of industry saying, listen, I'm telling you, China, for example, rising power, they are about to eat our lunch, they are, you know, churning out so many engineers, we should really be worried, like, we've got to amp up our education system. And then I talk to somebody else a week later, and they'll say, you know, yes, it's true that China's rising, but there's no way that they could compete with our, you know, Silicon Valleys or, you know, that sort of creativity. Americans have that uniquely. You know, that's a very American thing. And, I kind of wanted to get to the bottom of this. And I talked to Hazel Marcus, this fascinating professor at Stanford, who has done tons of work on how people in Eastern countries and Western countries actually see motivation, creativity, like being part of a community, how they see those totally differently. And I'll play a little clip of an experiment she did.
We compared high school students with East Asian background with students with European background, meaning their parents were probably born in North America or in Europe for the most part. And we looked at those students solving problems, and especially solving problems that were difficult and at the point that they were struggling with the problem, with failing. And what we found in our studies is that for the students with East Asian background, thinking about their mom at that time of failure actually boosted their motivation. It ignited their motivation. And we found exactly the opposite with the students of European American background in the same classroom.
Uh-huh. So I mean, I'm just trying to think. This also came up in another story around kind of a lot of this sort of came out in that whole sort of tiger mom thing as well, didn't it?
Yes, yeah. Amy Chua, yes.
Right.
Yes, and really, in some ways, what Hazel Marcus is doing there in that experiment does speak to the whole, like, when that tiger mother controversy came up of, like, is a Chinese style of parenting better than an American style? Well, it's very different. One thing that Hazel Marcus did is she went to the San Francisco International Airport with a questionnaire for people to fill out who are getting off of planes. And she said, can you fill out this questionnaire? And she gave them pens, 5 pens. She said, you just choose what pen you want. And there were 4 of one color and 1 of a different color. And the people of East Asian background almost always chose 1 of the 4 that were the same color. But Westerners wanted to be unique. They always chose the different color.
Mm-hmm.
And what you see is this real divergence over time. And this idea of that being part of the community is good versus like being a cowboy, getting out there, being like the one and only, the Steve Jobs, the Mark Zuckerberg. And we sort of have all these mythologized people of like, this guy did it on his own. I mean,
right.
He probably didn't do it on his own, but we sort of mythologized that he did.
Right. Well, and I mean, Jobs is an absolutely perfect example with the kind of after Walter Isaacson's biography of Jobs, now the kind of the faithful at Apple are kind of trying to re-engineer this hagiography of Jobs,
yeah.
Even though we know that the components in Apple products are, you know, are produced using this black box process where people are making one small component, they don't have no understanding of what their component, how their component relates to another component, and that those many of those products are sourced obviously in, you know, places like China, where, which are perceived generally as just being a market, you know, for Apple products.
Right.
But in fact,
right,
they're completely integral to the process. And then they're kind of, you know, they set up this whole mythology around Jobs as being this kind of, you know, brilliant innovator and stuff. I mean, it is a really interesting observation, but it's something that you know, is being increasingly challenged, I hope, because I think, you know, rather than just seeing, you know, places like China as just markets for products that are being designed by these brilliant mavericks, then, you know, what about partnerships and that kind of stuff? You know, is
that's right. Oh, no, I totally agree with you. And actually, if people want to hear the whole discussion, it's at innovationhub.org. But one of the interesting components of this is, okay, so we're all people. Why did we end up so different? Like, why do some of us see the lone hero as the answer and some of us see the community as the answer? And it turns out it may be wheat versus rice, which is like this totally fascinating, we get into it, uh-huh, but rice growing societies versus wheat growing societies tend to be really different in how they look at individualism. And so,
what an amazing difference. I just want to add one more totally offbeat observation. My Cleveland Cavaliers are going to win an NBA championship, but there's a big debate in the NBA about who should be the MVP, and there's all this stuff. Well, the Cleveland Cavaliers coach is David Blatt, 55 years old. He's been coaching in Israel, in Russia, all throughout Europe, and this is his first year coaching American professionally. And he said, when I coached in Israel, in Russia, all throughout Europe, nobody ever talked about who the MVP was. It was always about which teams are the best teams together. And in the United States, we're fixated on an individual. It's fascinating.
Right, so, right. That is so interesting.
Yeah, it's culturally, it just seems, it goes across there. It's very interesting.
Yeah,
and you know what popped into my mind was Richard Slotkin's book, Gunfighter Nation and the Myth of the Frontier, which is kind of a really insightful, you know, look at how the kind of the notion of sort of, you know, pushing back frontiers and boundaries kind of developed in the American, I mean, it's, you know, anyway, so that's my little contribution, right, is some yeah, additional reading there. Get into that book as a kind
you
of...
You had to go highbrow. I went to the lowest brow you could go, American sports, and thank you, Matthew.
There's nothing lowbrow about American sports in popular culture at all.
Yeah.
But earlier, Kari, we were talking about robots writing articles, and of course, a lot of that depends on the connectivity and being able to transmit huge amounts of information and data through broadband and the internet. And just tell us what you've been talking about in terms of looking at things like education,
right,
you know, access to education, and also I've got some new figures here that you might be interested in that just were released by the Associated Press on access to broadband, some national figures on accessibility, which are pretty fascinating. But tell us what you've been thinking about in this area.
Well, so this is an interesting thing because I think that most of us walk down the street and pretty much see everybody over about, I don't know, the age of like 9 attached to a phone and assume that this stuff, this kind of technology is pretty pervasive, that every kid is pretty much there texting their friends and doing Snapchat and Twitter and whatever and going on Facebook. And it turns out there is a huge and growing digital divide. And some of it is maybe what you might think in terms of kids in poor families don't have as much access to the iPhone or the iPad kind of thing. But some of it is that kids in poor families have some access. But A, they don't have a good broadband connection like you're talking about. So you think about something like Khan Academy, which is well known for having little algebra modules and little chemistry modules that you can learn from. Well, if you don't have good broadband, you can't watch those things, right? You can't learn. You can't take advantage of all this opportunity there is out there on the internet.
Absolutely. And in the couple of minutes we've got left, Kara, just also the other thing that's really jumped out of these figures from the Associated Press is the rural and urban divide, which is, you know, kind of not surprising. Mm-hmm. But there are some really significant figures here in New York State, just by for context. Half a million rural New Yorkers don't have access to high-speed internet. In Massachusetts, where you're talking to us from, it's kind of a similar proportion in terms of the percentage of the rural population who don't have access to high-speed broadband, about 20% roughly. So for me, it's not just I'm also interested in thinking about how what implications that lack of access can have to that portion of the population in with regards to things like telemedicine and those kinds of services that are now being seen as solutions, particularly to things like rural health.
Exactly. No, that's exactly right. And what you see when you're talking about kids is both that access gap, and then once they get on the internet, they're also kids in the bottom part of the income bracket. They tend to lack guidance. So the things they do when they get on also aren't as enriching. So here we have the internet, which in many ways is free, right? And we would think would be a force of equalizing. But when you talk to experts, it turns out that the gap is just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And so the internet tends to supercharge the kids who are already ahead because they're doing all sorts of creative stuff online. They're writing fan fiction. They're composing their own music. So we're talking like stuff they do in their free time, but it's sort of building them up. And kids who are at the lower end, they don't have the access. And when they do, they don't really know what to do with it. So they don't end up doing things that sort of make them a better writer, make them a more creative person, teach them how to code, that sort of thing. And I'll leave you with like the single best statistic I heard on this, which is people in the top 20% of the income bracket spend 10 times on their kids, not double, 10 times on their kids what people in the bottom 20% do.
Wow.
And that's like the gap we're facing.
Well, Karith, it's always great to catch up with you. And thanks for spending some time with us on Innovation Friday today.
Thank you.
And innovationhub.org is where you can go and follow up on the stories we've been talking about with Kara Miller. Go there, check out their blog. There's lots of links and some terrific reporting there. And we'll talk to you again, Kara. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Matthew, Khan Academy is working with the College Board to help with SAT prep because for years we've known wealthier families have kids who get better scores because they get expensive tutors. Khan Academy wants it to be free, online. But if there's still no connectivity, there's still a gap there. Remarkable stuff.
Right, so we're going to come back and talk about municipal broadband. That's
there
next,
you go.
Next time
that, we have
Friday.
Planted the seed. Matthew, great work as always. InnovationTrail.org. Thank you for taking the time as always.
Great to be with you. Thanks, Evan.
Second Opinion Live is next with Elisa Orlando.